From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the best-selling of the best-selling authors, John Grisham. His legal thrillers include The Firm, The Client, and The Pelican Brief, which have been adapted into films. His new novel, The Summons, is his first legal thriller in 2 years. Also, we hear from actress Elaine Stritch. Next week, she opens on Broadway with her one-woman show, At Liberty, in which she reminisces about her long career, including starring roles in musicals by Noel Coward and Stephen Sondheim. Language commentator Jeff Nunberg considers the word capitalism, and TV critic David Bianculli considers how new technology and the specter of terrorism will affect TV coverage of the Winter Olympics. The opening ceremony is tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is in Salt Lake City for tonight's opening ceremony of the 2002 Winter Olympics. Earlier today, the president expressed confidence in the $300 million security effort at the Games. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
After a meeting with leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the president told reporters that the Olympics give the world the chance to celebrate peace and freedom. Mr. Bush is scheduled to participate in the opening ceremony later by formally declaring the Games open, a task reserved for the head of state of the nation hosting the Olympics. The ceremony will open with a tribute to the victims and survivors of the September 11th attacks. American athletes will carry the so-called Ground Zero flag found in the rubble of the World Trade Center. Mr. Bush said the procession will strike the proper balance between patriotism and the international flavor of the Games. 50,000 people are expected to attend the ceremony, which will be guarded by Black Hawk helicopters, F-16s, and a massive security force on the ground. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says some of the prisoners from Afghanistan are cooperating with interrogators at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Rumsfeld said some prisoners have given important information that may have helped prevent future terrorist attacks. The secretary also defended President Bush's decision to grant Geneva Convention protection to Taliban soldiers, but not to members of al-Qaeda, while denying prisoner of war status to both groups. The International Red Cross has complained that the administration's policy still fails to meet the standards of international law. Kenneth Lay, the former chairman of Enron, has been subpoenaed to appear before Congress next week. One senator says he may testify rather than take the protection of the Fifth Amendment. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
Lawyers from the Senate Commerce Committee have been in touch with Lay's lawyers in preparation for Tuesday's hearing. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan says congressional staff told Lay's attorneys that it's customary to let the Senate know ahead of time if a witness will be taking the Fifth. Senator Dorgan.
They indicated that they are not doing so at this point, and so our attorney said on that basis we will prepare a hearing expecting Mr. Lay to testify. They said we have no disagreement with that.
Dorgan stressed this implied agreement may change. A spokesperson for Lay says he is still weighing his options and has not yet decided whether to testify. Lay is also scheduled to appear before the House Financial Services Committee next Thursday. A spokesperson for that committee says Lay has to show up, but whether to speak is up to him and his lawyer. Emily Harris, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 118 points, or 1.2%, to close at 9,744 in heavy trading. For the week, the Dow was down 163 points. The Nasdaq gained 36 points to close at 1818. The S&P 500 lost 16. This is NPR News. Federal safety officials warned pilots today to be careful not to put too much pressure on the rudders of their planes, especially during the types of sudden, evasive maneuvers they might have to take to thwart terrorists. The National Transportation Safety Board said excess pressure on the rudder can cause a catastrophic failure. This warning stems from an NTSB investigation of the American Airlines crash that killed more than 250 people in New York last fall. The UN is giving up on its efforts to set up a so-called genocide court in Cambodia. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations.
The court was to prosecute surviving Khmer Rouge leaders for genocide and other crimes committed in the late 1970s during the Khmer Rouge's brutal rule. But Now, after more than 4 years of negotiations with Cambodia, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has instructed his legal advisor to tell Phnom Penh that the UN will no longer be involved in setting up such a court. His concern is that Cambodia's plan would not guarantee impartiality and objectivity, two preconditions for UN cooperation. Meanwhile, UN spokesman Fred Eckhart said that Phnom Penh was demanding that only its rules would govern UN assistance with the court. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
Investigators in New York City have lowered the official death toll from the World Trade Center attacks. Officials now say the number of people killed is just over 2,800. Pathologists have identified the remains of more than 700 people, and families of nearly 2,000 others have requested death certificates because of evidence that proved their family members were in the towers. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Grisham has sold more novels for adults than any other living writer. With his new book, The Summons, he returns to the genre that made him famous, the legal thriller. His previous two books were an autobiographical novel and a novella. His best-selling legal thrillers include The Firm, The Client, The Pelican Brief, The Runaway Jury, and A Time to Kill. Even if you haven't read any of his books, you've probably seen some of their film adaptations. Before he was the king of the legal thriller, he was what he describes as a street lawyer in a suburb of Memphis. When I spoke with Grisham in 1997, he said that his first novel, A Time to Kill, was his most autobiographical thriller. I read him an excerpt of the introduction that he'd written for a new edition. One day I stumbled upon a horrible trial in which a young girl testified against the man who brutally raped her. It was a gut-wrenching experience for me, and I was only a spectator. One moment she was courageous, the next pitifully frail. I was mesmerized. I could not imagine the nightmare she and her family had been through. I wondered, what would I do if she were my daughter? As I watched her suffer before the jury, I wanted personally to shoot the rapist. For one brief yet interminable moment, I wanted to be her father. I wanted justice. There was a story there. And that's the story that you developed into A Time to Kill. Did you think you were capable of that kind of revenge?
At that moment, I sure did. In that courtroom, only a few feet away from the defendant, all of us who were there, I think collectively we felt very capable of inflicting some measure of revenge upon this this defendant who had, you know, done things to this little girl that beyond description. But there were moments during her testimony when I was facing the jury. Off to the side, and I knew three of the jurors, three out of the 15, and they were all covering their eyes because they were crying. And the judge was also trying to cover his eyes. And the prosecutor, a man I knew well and who could cry instantly, was also crying. And even the defendant's own lawyers were, you know, studying their shoes, and it, you know, was beyond, well, emotion's not an adequate word, but it would, I think it would have been easy right then at that moment to get revenge.
People were crying during the daughter's testimony?
Yeah, little girl's testimony. It was just, you know, she would start crying, and before long, everybody else was covering their faces, and it was, this went on for a couple of hours, and the courtroom was locked. The spectators had been excluded by the judge because he knew her testimony would be so graphic and so difficult for her. She was only 12 years old, and it was, you know, we just suffered through it, and I was very anxious to get out of there. I was just a nosy spectator.
Yeah, why were you there in the first place? I mean, well, you had your own cases. What interested you?
It was in the early days of my legal career, and at times, if I didn't have a lot to do, I'd go hang around the courtroom, especially if good lawyers were in town trying good cases, because I wanted to be a trial lawyer. And this particular crime had been so heinous and so notorious that we knew when the trial was going to occur, and so I just kind of hung around one day to see what was going to happen. And, suddenly there I was in the courtroom, and the local lawyers can come and go at will pretty much, in a courtroom. And we know the judges and all that, and so the judge was not going to exclude me when he closed the courtroom. We took a break after a couple of hours of this, and because the little girl just had to have a break, and the judge kept asking her if she wanted a break, and finally she said yes, and so we cleared the courtroom, and everyone was anxious to leave the courtroom, the jury, the judge, and we did. And in my haste to get out of the courtroom, I left behind my briefcase, and I didn't realize it until I was at my car, which is downstairs outside, and I realized I had to go back in the courtroom to get my briefcase. And I walked back through the back entrance of the courthouse, up the back stairs, through a side door, and suddenly there I was in the courtroom, and no one had stopped me, and I walked right by the defendant, who was sitting in a chair with a deputy a few feet away, the only two people in the courtroom. And it dawned on me how easy it would be to, get to the man who did that to my child. And it just floored me to think that I could have done it. I mean, and that's when the story was born.
This is an interesting thing about your position as a lawyer or a former lawyer and a novelist. As a lawyer, is your position to uphold the law. As the novelist, you're always creating characters who break it.
Yeah, and I'm troubled by that. I mean, I think I'll always be troubled by the story of A Time to Kill because it condones vigilantism and that type of justice. And, we cannot function as a society if the victims of crimes are allowed to seek their own remedies. And I don't know if I would write that story again.
John Grisham is my guest. In that first novel, A Time to Kill, you describe the lawyer Jake Brigance as he was clean-cut, conservative, a devout Presbyterian with a pretty wife who wanted babies. How close does that come to describing what you were like when you started your law career?
Pretty close. Again, there's a lot of autobiography. I'm not sure my wife wanted babies when we had them, but it was a joint effort. Small town, struggling lawyer, working hard, trying to get a break, trying to get a big case, trying to get a reputation in a town that's, filled with lawyers.
Clean cut, conservative?
Yeah, maybe not that conservative, maybe more of a politically moderate, Baptist, not Presbyterian, few differences. Clean cut, I guess, yeah.
What were your typical cases? If there's such a thing as typical cases.
Well, in the early days, the first 3 or 4 years of my law practice, I did a lot of criminal work, court-appointed criminal work for indigent clients who could not afford attorneys. Back then, in our local county, we didn't have a full-time public defender, so the criminal cases were assigned on a rotating basis to the younger lawyers. The older lawyers, of course, had to do it when they were younger, so it was an unwritten rule that the guys fresh out of law school would take the indigent cases, and I did a lot of those. The first year, I'd been out of law school less than a year when I had my first murder trial, which I was not equipped to handle. And then there was another murder trial shortly after that, and so I jumped into a lot of high-pressure courtroom work fresh out of law school, and that was fine with me because I wanted to do that kind of work, and I hoped to sort of gain the courtroom experience, become a good trial lawyer, as fast as possible, and later try more lucrative civil cases, and that's kind of what happened.
Did you feel guilty representing clients in cases that you felt you were not ready to really take on yet?
I would have felt guilty if we lost them, but I won both the murder cases with not guilty verdicts, and that does a lot for your confidence.
Yeah, I can imagine. And did you always truly believe in the innocence of the people you were defending, or did you have to be in the were you in the position sometimes of defending people who you really thought were guilty?
Well, both the murder cases involved some very strong defenses of self-defense. These were shootings, you know, and the question was who shot first. And my client did, in fact, kill the deceased, but the deceased in both cases were heavily armed. And, again, it's a question of self-defense. There were some cases I wouldn't take. I mean, I would never have defended a rapist or a child molester. I simply, you know, refused to do that. I represented a lot of people who were very guilty, and I never had any moral problems doing that. Lawyers can't worry about such things. Under our, you know, judicial and constitutional system, everybody's entitled to an attorney. And regardless of what you're charged with, you're entitled to legal representation. Somebody has to do it.
Did you usually leave cases feeling good about the law or feeling like you were let down by the results?
Most of the time, the system works. Most of the time, juries do what's right. Most of the time, settlements are fair. They're negotiated by both sides. And so the vast majority of the time when I closed a file, I was happy with what had been done. The clients were somewhat satisfied, and it was time to close the file and move on.
My guest is John Grisham. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Grisham has a new legal thriller called The Summons. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with him. Are there many cases in your novels that actually come from cases that you or colleagues close to you took on, or do you mostly invent things and make them a little bit larger than life?
Oh, much larger than life.
Right.
This is fiction, okay?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just outright fabrication.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't... I'm sure real live lawyers and real life cases sort of seep into the novels, but I don't build stories around them. I'm much more interested in creating something that's brand new. You know, a big trial against the insurance industry and the Rainmaker, or the trial against the tobacco industry and the runaway jury, or you know, I'd rather paint a larger canvas and maybe call some of my personal experiences occasionally, you know, as minor subplots. I don't really want to write about real people.
Why not?
Even fictionalized versions. Well, I don't want to get sued for one thing.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I mean, real kind of people. Do you want to write?
Well, I think a lot of my lawyers are stereotypes of or combinations of real people. I mean, you know, I study lawyers. I watch lawyers. I did when I was an attorney. I'd watch the good trial lawyers, and I spend a lot of time now watching lawyers, keeping up with legal developments, watching or keeping up with trials. And so, sure, I mean, most of my characters are compilations of, you know, real lawyers.
Do you go to the courthouse a lot now, or do you stay home and watch court TV?
Neither. I deplore the idea of televised trials. I always thought there was some sanctity in a very dignified courtroom where people could go and discuss things they would never discuss outside their own homes because they had to testify. But court TV has made a mockery of all that, and it's turned the actors and judges into, you know, media celebrities and actors. I don't really hang around courtrooms because, for the most part, it's very boring stuff. And I can't think of anything worse than watching a long trial. But I follow trials. You know, it's you can get the daily summaries in the papers, and I'm always, you know, watching issues and trying to piece together stories from current issues.
Was it interesting for you to watch how some people deal with pressure, how some people break and other people are able to manage during a trial?
Yeah, trial work is very stressful. It's high-powered, you know, high stakes, tons of pressure. And I've seen lawyers crack up in long trials. Others seem to thrive on the combat in the courtroom.
What about you? How'd you do?
I didn't really enjoy it. I mean, I thought I wanted to be a trial lawyer, but honestly, I never had any fun in the courtroom. I never enjoyed myself, even when I was winning. You don't win until it's all over, so you can't, you know, you worry about defeat up until the very end. But I had trials against lawyers who just seemed to love the sport and the pressure, mm-hmm, of the courtroom. And I was never that way. I never was able to relax. I'd lose sleep, you know. Long trial, you don't eat much, you don't sleep much. A lot of lawyers turn to alcohol because of that, because it is high pressure. And I knew a lot of those guys. But I didn't handle the pressure very well.
What about the competition in the games opposing lawyers play with each other, trying to psych each other out? Did that trouble you too?
Yeah, it really does. Because especially if, you know, the opposing lawyer was from a very large firm, and it seemed like he always was, because I was a sole practitioner. I was what we called ourselves street lawyers, because we were representing people out on the streets, people who were injured or wronged or fired or whatever. And typically we're always suing insurance companies and big defendants, and they hire big lawyers and big firms, and they all come in packs and dress alike and, you know, have fancy degrees, and they just descend on the courtroom, and it can be very intimidating. And I always wanted to be one of those plaintiff's lawyers who could take on, you know, a small army of defense lawyers and do so successfully. I never made it, but there could be a lot of intimidation, and there was a lot of intimidation imposed on a young lawyer struggling to keep up with the big boys.
What year did you start writing your first novel?
Started in November of 84, same year I took office in the legislature.
Busy man. You were still practicing law, too?
Oh, yeah. That was what I was doing for a living. I mean, the legislature didn't pay hardly anything. The book writing was still a, you know, distant dream. And the only way I could write was to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to the office and write for an hour or two before the day started. And I did that over a period of, well, I got in the habit of doing it, and over a period of 3 years, the first book was completed, and it became so ingrained that when I finished A Time to Kill, I think virtually the next day I started writing the next book, which was The Firm.
When you were writing A Time to Kill and going to the office at 5:30 every morning, was that your home office or your legal office?
Oh, that was my legal office. It was about 5 minutes from my house. And it was on the main drag of our main street of our little town of 25,000, which is a suburb of Memphis, just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And so I would be there at 5:30 in the morning. I'd turn on all the lights so everybody driving by to work would be able to see that I was there, you know, at 5:30 in the morning.
Why, so you'd look industrious?
Yeah, you know, I got the reputation as a real hard-working young lawyer, you know.
Little did they know you weren't working on anybody's case.
I was up there trying to finish a book. And it was kind of funny, after The Time to Kill came out and I told the story, I had clients who said, so that's why my file never got taken care of. We were up there trying to write a novel.
So nobody knew you were really writing a novel?
Nobody but my wife. Nobody. I didn't tell anybody until the book was finished. Renee read each chapter as I wrote it, but she was the only one. I mean, I wasn't about to tell anybody. And see, it took 3 years, and at least for 2 years, the first 2 years, I was not even sure I was going to finish it. I mean, there was really nothing to talk about. And I remember one day realizing that the story was half through. And at some point in there, I was determined to go ahead and finish it. But there was a lot of doubt. I think I went 4 weeks one time without working on it. And there were many times when I didn't want to work on it. It was just, I mean, I didn't want to get up at 5 in the morning. I wanted to sleep for, you know, another hour or so. And I often wonder now, you know, what would have happened had I quit?
Do you ever wonder why you had this urge then to write before you knew if it was anything in it for you, if you could even complete the book?
Well, I wanted to see if I could do it. I wanted to get it typed and have this big stack of pages and then try to get it published. And once I realized I was going to finish it, then I began having all these wonderful dreams about getting it published. And once you start thinking about getting published, you start thinking about bestsellers and movies and all that stuff. And it's a whole lot of fun to dream about that, and I got caught up in that. That prompted me to finish the book and to write the next one and to start thinking about, just the dream of a big book and lots of money.
You said, how did the dream compare to the reality?
You can only dream so much. The reality is far in excess of anything I ever dreamed back then. It is an enormous amount of fun to be able to write for a living and to have the books, you know, well received by a lot of folks, and it's still a dream.
John Grisham, I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Grisham recorded in 1997. He has a new legal thriller called The Summons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at audiusa.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we talk with actress Elaine Stritch about working with Noel Coward. She opens on Broadway next week with her one-woman show. Also, language commentator Jeff Nunberg considers the word capitalism, and TV critic David Bianculli looks ahead to coverage of the Winter Olympics. The opening ceremony is tonight. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, the Enron collapse was a demonstration of, quote, the genius of capitalism. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg was struck by that remark and the way defenders of the free market system have reclaimed the word capitalism for their own.
In the wake of the Enron collapse, some Bush administration officials were describing it as a vindication of the free market system. Economic advisor Larry Lindsay called it a tribute to American capitalism, and Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill made the same point even more fulsomely. Companies come and go, he said. Part of the genius of capitalism is that people get to make good decisions or bad decisions, and then they get to pay the consequence or enjoy the fruits of their decisions. That's the way the system works. As even Business Week and Fortune pointed out, it wasn't exactly the moment for bromides about the genius of capitalism, particularly since the people who'd made the bad decisions at Enron weren't the ones who were paying most of the consequences. But Lindsay and O'Neill didn't intend to sound callous. Rather, their remarks showed just how reflexive this sort of rhetoric has become among free market zealots. It's not just the way they greet each corporate collapse as a triumph of capitalism, but the fact that they mention capitalism at all. 15 or 20 years ago, free market partisans would have been more likely to say, that's how our free enterprise system works. Capitalism's never been a dirty word exactly, but it's always had a polemical tone ever since it was given its modern sense by socialist writers in the mid-19th century. The phrase free enterprise was invented by economists about 100 years ago in order to dispel the noxious images that had grown up around the word capitalism: bloated plutocrats, workers bent over their machines, strike breakers, and the rest. Free enterprise wears its ideology on its sleeve. It suggests a connection between political freedom and the right to go about your business without the meddlesome interference of bureaucrats, by the way, another word that acquired its pejorative sense around then. And in place of predatory monopolists like Carnegie and Rockefeller, who were giving capitalism a bad name, free enterprise conjures up the plucky young newsboys from the rags-to-riches tales of Horatio Alger. For most of the 20th century, free enterprise has been the homey Chamber of Commerce name for capitalism. There's a chair of free enterprise at the University of Texas at Austin, a center for free enterprise at the University of South Florida, a Dr. Pepper Free Enterprise Institute in Waco, and a Free Enterprise Leadership Conference held every year by the Jesse Helms Center in Wingate, North Carolina. And the word capitalism doesn't appear at all in the web pages of the Horatio Alger Society, a group that honored Kenneth Lay a couple of years ago for, as they put it, helping young people to value the opportunities presented by America's free enterprise system. Still, capitalism has always had some defenders who weren't reticent about calling it by its given name, particularly the disciples of Ayn Rand and of libertarian economists like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek. These tend to be people who come to the defense of capitalism with something more like religious zeal. You could hear some of that in the exuberant profession of faith that Kenneth Lay made to an interviewer a while ago. "I believe in God and I believe in free markets," he said, and went on to suggest that Jesus would have agreed with him. Needless to say, that level of zeal changes the terms of the discussion. When people extol the virtues of free enterprise, they usually invoke the rising standard of living and the inventions it spawns. When they talk about the virtues of capitalism, they're more likely to go on about the moral values of individualism and the freedom to fail, the lesson that both O'Neill and Lindsay were quick to read in the Enron debacle. It's a little scrap of bombast you can trace directly back to Ayn Rand's turgid philosophizing, the notion that capitalism is never so glorious as when it's strewing the ground with bodies. There was a time when this kind of talk was considered a little irresponsible by the respectable free marketeers who were earnestly promoting the virtues of free enterprise over socialism and the welfare state. But after the fall of communism and the freewheeling markets of the 90s, capitalism is back, and free enterprise has started to sound a little musty. It's gotten to where the word capitalism was probably as frequent inside the ballrooms at the World Economic Forum in New York as it was on the signs of the demonstrators in the street. But the right's reclamation of the word capitalism hasn't extended to its cousin capitalist. Forbes magazine tried to reclaim that word a while ago when it started billing itself as a capitalist tool. But capitalist is still in the closet, at least when it comes to using it as a job description. People talk about capitalist societies or capitalist economies, and you can describe somebody as a venture capitalist, which is really just a derivative of venture capital. But Forbes and the Wall Street Journal don't ever apply the C word to people like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, or Rupert Murdoch. Those are investors, entrepreneurs, moguls, or simply businessmen. Reading the business press, you might conclude that America has finally realized the dream of building capitalism without capitalists, that we're free at last from the rapacious class that once held the economy at its mercy. As Secretary O'Neill put it, it's just the way the system works.
Jeff Nunberg is the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, actress Elaine Stritch talks about Noel Coward. Her one-woman show opens on Broadway next week. This is Fresh Air. Next week, Elaine Stritch opens on Broadway with her one-woman show, At Liberty, in which she reminisces about her more than 50-year career and sings some of the songs she's known for. She's best known for her starring role in Noel Coward's musical, Sail Away, a role he wrote for her, and her performance in Stephen Sondheim's musical, Company, in which she sang The Ladies Who Lunch. Early in her career, she starred in a Broadway revival of Rodgers and Hart's Pal Joey and understudied Ethel Merman in Call Me Madam. More recently, she was in the Harold Prince revival of Showboat. I spoke with her in 1999. In honor of Noel Coward's centennial, she was starring in a production of his musical Sail Away, recreating her role as Mimi Paragon, the director of a cruise ship who has to deal with the needy and often irritating passengers. Here she is singing Coward's song about insufferable tourists, Why Do the Wrong People Travel, from the 1961 original cast recording of Sail Away.
They say improves the mind, an irritating platitude, which frankly entre-new is very far from true. Personally, I've yet to find that longitude and latitude can educate those scores of monumental bores who travel in groups and herds and troops of various breeds and sexes, till the whole world reels to shouts and squeals and the clicking of Rolleiflexes. Why do the wrong people travel, 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 when the right people stay back home? What compulsion compels them, and who the hell tells them to drag their clans to Zanzibar instead of staying quietly in Omaha? The Taj Mahal and the Grand Canal and the sunny French Riviera would be less oppressed if the Middle West would settle for somewhere rather nearer. Please do not think that I criticize or cavil at a genuine urge to roam. But why, oh why, do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home and mind their business when the right people stay back home with Cinerama when the right people stay back home? I'm merely asking why the right people stay back home.
Elaine Stritch, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm wondering what personal meaning the story of Sail Away had for Noel Coward. For instance, Graham Payne and Sheridan Morley edited the diaries of Noel Coward, and in their introduction, they wrote that Sail Away reflected his passion for travel, his loathing of tourists, his horror of old age, and his love of the sun. Did he talk with you at all about traveling and how his ideas about traveling figured in to the story of Sail Away?
No. He didn't. He is not Gadge Kazan. He is not one of those kind of directors. He had a young woman on his hands who had a lot of responsibility ahead of her. And he loved me. That was the best part. And I loved him. And when you've got that, you don't have many problems, Terry. You really don't. It's what I miss when I go into rehearsal for a show and I don't get that connect. I don't get any chemical connection with the director. You might as well go home. It's not worth going to rehearsal. I mean, somebody's got to understand you, and you've got to understand them. It's like a bad marriage, but this was a good marriage. And he did not go into depths about how he felt. He explained to me how he wanted me to play this part, and I was very right for the part, according to Noel. I had Mimi Paragon, his idea of her humor, and her. He must have seen some depth in me, or he would never have turned this part over to me.
What was it like rehearsing with Noel Coward? What kind of advice
wonderful,
did he give
brilliant.
You about the songs and how to sing them?
Just wonderful. He would. Everything was, not everything was a joke, but everything had humor. Everything. And humor, to me, is one of the most important virtues, I call it, qualities that anybody can have about anything. I don't care whether you're digging ditches or singing Noel Coward. If you do it with humor, you're ahead of the game. And he certainly had a double scoop of that.
Did he give you advice about singing his lyrics or about singing his melodies?
No. Richard Rodgers, he was not, if you'd follow me.
Well, what kind of advice would Rodgers give you that Noel Coward wouldn't?
exacting to the point of suicide. But I loved him. But boy, I'll give you an example. I sang Zip for Richard Rodgers. This is a great antithesis to Noel Coward. I sang Zip in Pal Joey long before I did the Noel Coward show. And I used to say, Zip, Walter Lippmann wasn't brilliant today. And he would stop me and say, Elaine, it is Zip, Walter Lippmann was. And I said, oh, Jesus. And as soon as he left the theater, I'd sing, Zip, Walter Lippmann. So I was a bad girl. But I was so convinced that I was right about that. And just between you and me, I was right. I'm telling that story for the reason is that Noel respected your interpretation, that extra something that you brought to his music. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
He was very appreciative of it, and if you were wrong, did you get it? I wouldn't want to meet Noel Coward in a dark alley. I can tell you that right now. I don't want Noel Coward mad at me.
Did he ever get mad with any of the cast members, and what was
yes,
he like
then? Yes,
he did,
indeed. Yes, absolutely. There was a young guy that came to rehearse audition for Noel Coward, and I happened to be in the theater that morning, and of course Noel always looked like $1 million. And this guy came in to sing for Noel Coward, and he had jeans on and a dirty sweatshirt and blah, blah, blah. And and Noel would say, are you going to sing for me? And this young man said, well, it's okay with me. I don't care. You know, he was rude and awful and filthy and just unbelievable. And he said, I can sing Star Spangled Banner. Oh, boy. So Noel, who was very full of curiosity, said, do you have an accompanist? This young man said, no, I just sing it. So he said, well, just sing it. And the young man sang it, and Noel interrupted him halfway through it. He said, young man, I'm not going to let you finish. I want you to leave the theater. I want you to stop maybe by on your way home and pick up a very, very inexpensive white shirt, preferably, and a new pair of jeans, which are perfectly all right with me, and some nice, clean sneakers. And then I want you to go home. And then I want you to take a very, very long shower with a lot of soap and a lot of water. And then I want you to get out of the shower and put on your clean jeans and your new shirt and your new scuffies. And then I think you should get out of the theater because you have absolutely no talent at all. Well, It was brilliant. I fell about, and my laugh came out from the back of the theater. And he said, "Good morning, Strachey." And then he went right on, and this guy left with a shrug of his shoulders like he didn't understand one bloody thing he just heard. He thought this man was from Mars, naturally. Anyway, what a guy. What a terrific. And it wasn't mean, you know? It was just brilliant.
I want to read a couple of things that have been said about your relationship with Noel Coward. Graham Payne, who was a good friend of Noel Coward, wrote this about you in his book about Noel Coward. He said, "Coward cherished Elaine Stritch's similarities with Gertrude Lawrence, her verve, her irreverence, her infectious vulgarity." And Cole Leslie, who I think was Noel Coward's secretary and wrote a book about him, said, "Elaine Stritch's devout Catholicism perhaps fascinated Noel the most." And Noel Coward wrote himself in his diary, "Stritch was wildly enthusiastic and very funny, but I foresee little clouds in the azure sky. She is an ardent Catholic and has been in analysis for 5 years. Oh, dear." So
I think it's a great combination, and it certainly figures if you're an ardent Catholic that you'd end up on a couch.
Right.
So I knew exactly where he was coming from. Not then, but I do now.
Why do you think he was so fascinated by your Catholicism?
Well, because I was very serious about it. And I, you know, said my prayers and went to Mass and Communion and stuff like that. And then I would say four-letter words occasionally. And that combination made him laugh and fascinated him. I smoked, I drank, I did all the kicking my heels up type things. But I went to Mass on Sunday. So they say that he's an honest man, you know, that kind of thing.
Elaine Stritch recorded in 1999. Her one-woman show, At Liberty, opens on Broadway next week. Here she is with her signature song, The Ladies Who Lunch, from the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Company.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh. Lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch on their own behalf. Off to the gym. Then to a fitting, claiming their fat, and looking grim, 'cause they've been sitting, choosing a hat. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'll drink to that. Here's to the girls who stay smart. Aren't they a gas? Rushing to their classes in optical art, wishing it would pass. Another long, exhausting day. Another $1,000. A matinee, a pinter play. Perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that. And one for Mahler. Here's to the girls who play wife. Aren't they too much? Keeping house but clutching a copy of Life just to keep in touch. Ones who follow the rules and meet themselves at the schools, too busy to know that they're fools. Aren't they a gem? I'll drink to them. Let's all drink to them.
Elaine Stritch from the original cast recording of Company. Coming up, David Bianculli on TV coverage of the Winter Olympics. This is Fresh Air. The 2002 Winter Olympic Games begin tonight, with NBC broadcasting the opening ceremonies live from Salt Lake City. From now through February 25th, NBC will present live coverage nightly, with additional coverage provided by CNBC and MSNBC. TV critic David Bianculli has some thoughts about how technology and terrorism have affected this year's games.
One of my regular complaints about TV's coverage of the Olympic Games has been how annoyingly jingoistic it gets. Back when Jim McKay was reporting from the Olympics in the 60s and 70s for ABC, that network presented more of a feeling of discovery and of international unity. Sure, it was great to cheer the United States on to victory. The hockey team's 1980 upset win against the Soviet team at the height of the Cold War was a classic TV sports event. But back then, TV seemed to take pride in the accomplishments of others as well. We heard more national anthems from other winning countries, and learned almost as much about their athletes, up close and personal, as we did our own. As different networks and personnel took on the Olympics, things changed. CBS, by and large, favored an America-first approach in a very heavy-handed way when it broadcast the Olympics. NBC, with such loser ideas as the pay-per-view triple cast, spread itself too thinly and cared about other countries and their athletes too little. NBC has the Olympics again this year, and with what happened on September 11th, patriotism, as well as international unity, are bound to be front and center throughout the games. At the last Olympics, the touching highlight of the opening ceremonies was Muhammad Ali lighting the Olympic torch. At this Olympics, it'll be tough to top the 8 U.S. athletes who are scheduled to carry a torn and battered American flag, the one recovered from Ground Zero days after the attack on the World Trade Center. Context at these games will be everything. There's not only the patriotism to consider, but the terrorism. And not just regarding the pipe bomb in Atlanta, but going all the way back to the terrorist attack on Israeli athletes in Munich at the 1972 Summer Games. This is NBC's first shot at broadcasting the Winter Games, and Bob Costas, who's really good, will serve as host. But in what I consider a fabulous acknowledgement that history and perspective are important at these games, NBC has hired as a special contributor Jim McKay, on loan from ABC. McKay, now 80 years old, reported from Munich that awful year, and his presence in the studio with Costas is one reason to give NBC and this year's coverage the benefit of the doubt. Another reason is that NBC is trying its triple cast idea again, but this time without asking viewers to pay for it. In addition to the primetime coverage every night on NBC, Olympic coverage will be available day and night on CNBC and MSNBC. If you want to see early round hockey games or follow the U.S. curling team, NBC's sister cable networks are the places to go. Don't laugh about curling, by the way. At the last Olympics, while David Letterman was making fun of it on CBS, I was watching it on the CBC, Canada's national network, and got hooked on it. While many Winter Olympic events are billed quite properly as the original extreme sports, curling, if anything, is extremely slow. It's like shuffleboard on ice, with team members furiously sweeping with brooms to decrease the friction as the heavy stones sail slowly towards their targets. On Canadian TV, the commentators get into curling in a big way, and so do the athletes, who are mic'd and who scream at the curling stones and each other during each shot. Here's Sanda Schmirler launching a stone for Canada during the 1998 games.
And of course, Sandra Schmirler is a three-time world champion. She won in Geneva in 1993, in Oppersdorf, Germany in 1994, and last year in Bern, Switzerland, defeating Dordi Nordby in the final. And in her second game today, she will face her Norwegian opponent.
Now you hear Jan Bettger yelling, "Line's fine, it's just a question of her weight." They have to go hard on it to get it close to being shot rock. Oh, and just about a foot and a half short. Beautiful line.
Shoot.
Schmirler in Canada won the gold that year, but the three-time world champion died of cancer 2 years ago. As it rebuilds and tries to defend its gold medal, the Canadian women's curling team has a dramatic story to tell. On one of the cable networks, at least, I hope to be able to see it. And that's a good thing, because one of the technological innovations since the last Olympics has robbed me of my ability to watch the CBC on my giant satellite dish. The signal went digital, but I didn't, so I'm stuck watching NBC alone. Oh well, at least there's one technological advancement NBC is adding to the games that's an instant winner. You know those virtual reality first down yard markers the networks superimpose electronically onto the field during football games? Well, NBC has taken that same gimmick and using it for the first time on ski jumps. As the skiers approach the ground, we'll know where they have to land to win and can see it as it happens. The as it happens part, by the way, may be the most involving part of these games. Because the events are held in this country, most events can be broadcast live, rather than taped and edited hours beforehand, which is what made NBC's coverage from Japan so irritating last time. So with the time zone advantage, the ski jump line, the multiple networks, the tattered flag, and Jim McKay, the 2002 Olympic Winter Games are setting themselves up nicely. Now it's up to the athletes and the broadcasters and ultimately the American TV audience.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the World of the Disabled, a work of nonfiction by Andrew Potok. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one young man's story about growing up in the inner city, getting a gun, going to prison, going back to prison, then trying to stay straight. He now works with other young people who have just gotten out of Rikers Island. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.